From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mary Fisher says the AIDS virus is not a political creature. It doesn't care whether you're a Democrat or Republican, straight or gay, male or female. Fisher is a straight, white mother of two and a Republican. She's HIV positive and a tireless AIDS activist. You probably saw her address the 1992 Republican National Convention. On today's Fresh Air, she tells us her story. Also, independent counsel Lawrence Walsh has issued his final report on the Iran-Contra affair. We'll discuss the report with Peter Kornbluh, the editor of a book which tells the history of the scandal by reprinting some of the most revealing secret documents that were declassified. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Attorney General Janet Reno was named as special counsel to probe President Clinton's ties to a failed Arkansas savings and loan while he was governor. Former U.S. Attorney Robert Fisk Jr., a Republican, will take the job. He's promising a complete, thorough, and impartial investigation. Fisk says the scope of his review will be as broad as necessary and will find out if anybody broke the law in the Whitewater dealings. This investigation is supposed to find out if the president or Mrs. Clinton improperly benefited from the failed SNL or from a failed real estate deal that may have been financed with some of the SNL's money. Weather forecasters are predicting rain and colder temperatures for the Los Angeles area this weekend. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is working with state officials to house people displaced by Monday's earthquake. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
The state has asked federal officials to supply travel trailers. FEMA's Richard Krim says this will allow some of the people displaced by the quake to get inside and to keep an eye on their houses.
These are travel trailers similar to what you would have hook onto the back of your automobile, but depending on the size of the family, two or three people could live, not comfortably, but they could live on a temporary basis in a travel trailer.
Krim says 100 such trailers are already on the way. The agency plans to buy at least 1,000 more. FEMA is also looking at using properties owned by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and it continues to offer reimbursements for rental housing. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
Authorities in the Midwest and the East report that 97 people have died from incidents related to the deep freeze blanketing the region. Deadly cold weather has closed schools, businesses, and even the federal government today. Utility officials in the mid-Atlantic states say they don't need to use rolling blackouts anymore to prevent large power failures. Robbie Harris of member station WHYY reports from Philadelphia.
Power company officials say conservation by energy customers is the reason the rolling blackouts have ended for now. Yesterday, intermittent power outages dotted the middle Atlantic states as officials worked to avoid a much larger blackout. Bill Jones is a spokesman for the Pennsylvania energy company PECO in Philadelphia. He says the outlook for today is better.
Luckily, people are still conserving with businesses closed and the city shut down. The load curve went up this morning, but not nearly as high as we had feared. So at this point, barring something unexpected, such as the loss of a major piece of generation, we seem to be okay, at least for the time being.
Jones says the next critical period will be from 5 to 7 o'clock this evening. For National Public Radio, I'm Robbie Harris in Philadelphia.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are up 7 points at 3,891. This is NPR. A key reformer has quit Russian President Boris Yeltsin's cabinet. Boris Fyodorov says he has no intention of staying in Yeltsin's government. Yeltsin has appointed a new cabinet dominated by conservatives opposed to rapid economic reforms. The finance minister's post had been left open for Fyodorov in the new government, but he's declined it. France is calling for the United States, Russia, and the European Union to speak urgently about the Bosnian war. French officials say they're reconsidering the situation now that Bosnian peace talks have collapsed again in Geneva. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Foreign Minister Alain Juppé told reporters after briefing the National Assembly's Foreign Affairs Committee that it was time to review the whole situation. He said that means drawing conclusions from what he called the obstinate determination of the warring factions to continue battling against each other instead of working towards peace. Juppé said he would contact leaders of the European Union, the United States, and Russia to discuss what steps to take next following the failure of the Bosnian Serbs, Croats, and Muslims to resolve their differences in Geneva. The French defense minister has suggested that if no progress towards peace is made by spring, France would consider pulling its troops out. It has the largest contingent there, more than 5,000 troops. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The former bodyguard of figure skater Tanya Harding claims that Harding knew about the alleged plot to attack her rival, skater Nancy Kerrigan. Bodyguard Sean Eckert has told the Oregonian newspaper that Harding was mad that the assault was taking too long to be carried out. Eckert also claims Harding's ex-husband, Jeff Galluli, offered him a bonus if he could hurt Kerrigan immediately. Eckert, Galluli, and two other men are charged with criminal conspiracy in trying to hurt Kerrigan. Harding denies any involvement. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mary Fisher represented the AIDS community in the 1992 Republican National Convention. Skeptics thought she was there because she was unlikely to alienate anyone. She's a straight, white mother of two who never injected drugs and whose father was the honorary chair of the Bush Reelection Finance Committee. But when she asked the Republican Party to lift its shroud of silence on AIDS, when she spoke about being HIV positive and expressed fears about the future of her two young sons, even the skeptics were moved. After the convention, Fisher became a tireless AIDS activist, traveling around the country, trying to dispel the myths about AIDS and the people who have it. Some of her speeches are collected in a new book called Sleep with the Angels. Betty and Gerald Ford are godparents of her oldest son. I asked Fisher if she sought Betty Ford's advice before deciding to go public about having HIV. After all, Ford had gone public with her own medical problems.
Yes, I spoke to Betty Ford and the president about what to do, how to make a difference was really my question to her. When I told them that I was HIV positive and we went through the trauma that any relationship goes through, we knew that there was going to be something I had to do because that's just my nature. And Betty has been a role model for me for many years. I asked her how or what would it take? Where would I make a difference? I asked a lot of people this, but I certainly took her counsel to heart. She was the one that probably held me off more than anybody else, because her advice was, once you say it, you can't take it back, so be very certain that this is what you want to do.
A lot of AIDS activists were really very angry with the Republican Party for what they saw of a lack of initiative to conduct AIDS research and to speak out about AIDS. Were you angry with the party, too, being a Republican yourself, when you spoke before your party's convention?
Terry, I have not a lot of anger inside. I don't like to live like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that it's productive. I've worked in and out of Washington for many years and know so many people here and realize that the way I can be of the best service is if I can work within the system. And the system doesn't handle anger very well. It handles constructive criticism. It handles suggestions, it handles discussions, but it doesn't handle anger very well. So my anger would not have been productive. I needed to help people get over the myths, try to begin to break down some of the walls of stigma so that they would at least hear what I had to say.
There was a documentary about you that was broadcast on Nightline. And within that documentary, you know, they had followed you around on various speaking engagements and at home. And at one of your speaking engagements, a young girl came up to you after you had done speaking, and she was crying and she was saying that I can't remember whether she had AIDS or HIV, but she felt the need to keep it secret, but she wanted to talk to you about it. But of course, all of this was picked up on the microphone and by the camera.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very moving moment and also a kind of surprisingly public one for for the girl who was trying to maintain her secrecy. I wondered what that moment was like for you.
It was a very hard moment because I knew the cameras were there and I wanted to protect her, and yet I knew she needed to talk to me, and that becomes difficult. That's not an unusual moment, Terry.
There this are, happens to you all the time?
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. There are people that don't tell anybody but may come and share it with me because they also know that I'm going through it. I since have become friends with this young girl and her family, and must tell you they are wonderful, wonderful people. And it's very difficult what AIDS does, not just to the person who is infected, but to the people that love us, to the people that live with us, to the people that surround us and work with us.
Let me get back to this girl.
Mm-hmm.
Has she changed her attitude about keeping it a secret since you spoke with her and since you've become friends?
Well, her attitude has been that she wants to talk about it. I think that it's now a part of the family discussion. And it's not something that any of us come to easily. It's not like you find out you're HIV positive or that you have AIDS and automatically you want to tell the world. It doesn't really happen like that. I think that the process that any family goes through takes time, and they are in that process.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own process, how after you found out that you were HIV positive, how you decided to tell people beyond your family and then to tell the public and to use it as an opportunity to discuss the issue politically and socially?
When I found out I was HIV positive, I was, of course, devastated because it's a terrible thing to learn when you don't believe that you're at risk. So coming to grips with some of that and coming to grips with my own mortality, and I don't know if we ever really come to grips with it, but that was a process that began with my family, with my doctors. And as some of that pain subsides, it's fairly in my nature to want to talk about things and to talk about what's going on in my life with my friends. I found it uncomfortable not to be able to say, when someone would say, "How are you?" to tell them what was going on. And I found that to be more and more a problem for me. And then I realized that I was hiding something from my children and hiding something from my children's parents, friends, and all the people that surround them, and that at some point, somebody was going to know and the children were going to hear things, and that wasn't really fair to them, and that I didn't want them to live like that. And this process went on. My doctor said he wanted me to wait for 6 or 7 or 8 months and to make a decision, because when you're in a crisis, it's not a good time to make a decision. And so during this period of time, I talked with people he recommended. I talked to my friends. I talked to family. I spoke to Betty Ford and the president, as I have said before, and asked the question, if I can make a difference, what could I do? Where could I throw the rock and get the most ripples? And everyone said, in the AIDS community, outside the AIDS community, if you could tell your story and felt comfortable just talking about you as a mom and how you contracted the disease and what it means to you and how you're dealing with it, that would make a difference just in and of itself, and if you could help one person. And I went into it believing that this was going to be good for my children. I wanted them to know that I stood for something and that I had the ability to help other people, and that even when we're faced with life-challenging problems, that we can turn it around and live the way we would like to live.
As you said before, it was a real shock to you when you found out that you were HIV positive, because you didn't think you fell into any of the risk categories. So it's something you hadn't really given any thought to. Your ex-husband, and you were divorced by then, had called you to tell you that he had HIV. What? Tell us more how you found out.
When Brian, who was my former husband, called to tell me that he was HIV positive, I was, because we had been divorced for a couple of years, was very concerned about him and worried for him. I didn't even at that point worry about myself. And then, of course, I went to have a test right away. And even when I found out about me, I was more than concerned about my son. It's a mix of emotions that throws you into almost a never-never land, like a twilight zone, because you have to keep going day to day, but you don't know how you do that. It's almost like being in shock. I was certain that I wouldn't get through that time of my life. I don't know, I suppose maybe with a spiritual foundation and wonderful family and friends, I made it through, but I really don't even know how to this day I made it through.
Were you angry with your husband? I mean, with your ex-husband, because, you know, you had gotten it from him. And even if just like on a purely irrational level. Leanne,
oh, at times,
you know,
absolutely. He was angry. We were both angry. We were angry at the system. We were angry with each other. We were angry and hurt because what do you do with the emotions? Where do you put it? I find that I don't deal well with anger, and I don't like to blame. And forgiveness has been a very large part of this for me. And I think for Brian at the end, and we mended much of our relationship. You know, I don't know if you can understand coming out of a divorce and going through a divorce and then having to face this. We had a lot of things that we needed to mend and to heal. And if not for us at the time, at least for the children. So it's the same piece about the anger is that I don't find anger productive. Didn't want to live in that place, but it took me some time to get over that part. Anger is just one emotion as you're dealing with loss.
For a lot of people who find out that they have HIV, telling people that they have HIV also ends up sometimes telling those people about personal things those people didn't know about before. For some people, other people find out that they're gay. For some people, it leads to information about intravenous drugs that they've used in the past, or, you know, a sexual relationship that nobody knew they'd had or something. I mean, that's sometimes the case, you know, that a secret becomes public after saying that you have HIV. I believe with your husband, a secret that he had kept from you was that he had used drugs, and that you found out about that after he told you about the HIV.
I welcome the question very often because I believe this is the only disease where people want to know how you got it. And in many ways, I resent that. Mm-hmm. I resent it because it shouldn't matter how a person contracts this disease. The important part was that I contracted this disease in my marriage. And for a very long time, I would say that what Brian did was what Brian did, and that anyone would have to talk to him about his. He said that he assumed that it was from experimenting with IV drugs. I knew that he had experimented with drugs. I didn't know the extent of it. It was never an issue. He wasn't doing that when I met him, and it wasn't part of our relationship. So this was a disease that it was contracted by him many years ago. It was somehow passed to me during our relationship, during our marriage. That is really the important piece of my whole story.
That it was in marriage.
It was in marriage. It was what, you know, people want to look at as any kind of relationship that anybody would have or that has. It makes one stop and think about their relationships.
You know, how you said that this is the only disease where people want to know, how did you get it? Do you think maybe part of the reason for that is that, I mean, I just asked myself, so I had my reasons for asking, but I think often people ask because for some people, the world of AIDS is divided into the innocent sick and the guilty sick. You know, the innocent sick are the people who got it through blood transfusions, and the guilty sick are the people who got it through things we don't like, homosexuality, drug use. Do you know what I'm saying? And so there's this division in a lot of people's minds about whether somebody, like, deserved it or not.
Well, but, I mean, nobody deserves this disease.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean,
but I'm just saying, and yeah. Nobody tries to get this disease. I don't think there's an innocent and a guilty. I don't consider myself a victim. I think that people, one of the reasons people like to ask, Terry, is because they would like to say, I didn't do that. Therefore, I must not be at risk. I don't need to worry about it. If you didn't do what I did, then you're not at risk. And people like to take themselves out of risk categories. I now need to tell you that everyone is at risk. There are no categories anymore. 90% of all new AIDS cases or HIV cases are heterosexual by nature. So I don't know where. I think it's because we're in denial. I think because there's a lot of fear. I think people don't want to deal with this disease. Therefore, they'll make people innocent and make people guilty. I think people like to judge, and I'm sorry for that, because it really does create divisions in communities where we don't need to do that.
My guest is Mary Fisher. I'm sure you heard her speak at the Republican convention about being HIV positive. She's become a tireless AIDS activist. There's a new collection of her speeches, and that's called Sleep with the Angels, A Mother Challenges AIDS. She also founded the Family AIDS Network. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mary Fisher, a collection of her speeches about being HIV positive is now out. It's called Sleep with the Angels. I think the line that really choked people up when you spoke at the Republican convention was when you said, if it's true that HIV inevitably turns to AIDS, then my children will inevitably turn to orphans. How have you explained HIV to your children?
My children are 4 and 6. They're really young. They understand. We first had to go through Brian's illness and Brian's death. I didn't want them to think that their mom was going to die tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't explain to them that I am exactly like their dad in that instance, because I feel that I don't want them to have fear. Mm-hmm. On a daily basis, that I'm going to be sick. Children don't understand illness unless if you're sick, you go to the doctor, you stay in bed, you physically are, you have manifestations of this illness. They don't see that with me. So we mainly talk about AIDS as a disease. We talk about HIV also as a disease. They know what I do. They've heard me speak. I answer their questions when they come up.
Do their questions ever really throw you? Are you ever unprepared for some of the things they want to know?
Just like any parent would be. It comes out of left field and you don't expect it. And sometimes they're asking a question and I have a tendency to attach a very serious answer to it when that's not really what they wanted to know at all. It was more like about the ribbon or something. So I have to really hear what they're asking me.
The Republican convention at which you spoke had an attitude that was pretty anti-gay, especially in the Family Values campaign. And so many AIDS activists are gay, and the gay community has been so hard hit by AIDS. How do you feel about the way your party has handled homosexuality, and how do you feel about how your party has dealt with AIDS?
I feel that everyone needs to understand my position. I don't feel these are political issues. I think there are Republicans that understand, and there are Democrats that understand, and there are Republicans and Democrats alike that do not understand and do not accept. I was never raised that way, Terry. I can't judge one person or not for caring about or having compassion for. I think part of it is people just don't understand, and they don't take the time to understand. They don't take the time to hear what people have to say.
Are you talking about AIDS or AIDS and homosexuality?
Both. Mm-hmm. I feel very strongly that we are all the same. That we are one. I really feel this way. I don't feel any different as a woman with AIDS. I have many friends who are gay, but so what? It doesn't. I don't think it makes any difference. I have always had friends who are in the gay community. It's never been an issue with me.
But I mean, for the party, for the Republican Party, it was an issue.
Well,
and they did politicize it. So I'm wondering how you responded to that, unless you'd rather not talk about it.
No, it's not that. It's just I responded by giving my speech and saying how I felt and being as honest and true as I could be to my own values. And I think that it's, my speech spoke for itself.
Do you think that it reached anyone in the party in a way they hadn't been reached before?
AIDS education is a process. I do believe that it reached some people, and I believe that there are many people in the party that will never be able to think about this disease exactly the same way again. They need to hear it again and again and again. Because people don't automatically go from not understanding, not hearing, to action. There's a tremendous amount of steps that happens in between. So it's my hope that they did. I really don't have any way of knowing or of measuring that. It's just a hope. And all I can do is throw it out there and hope that they catch it.
Before you got HIV, did you ever think of yourself as having the capability of becoming a public speaker, of becoming such a public person?
No, I never thought of myself as a public person. I was raised in a family that was fairly public in Detroit, but not like this at all.
You know, I'm thinking like you're saying your family was a public family, but in that way where they're public for their deeds, not for their feelings and for their personal lives. Did your parents understand what the impact would be when you started talking about your life, and did they support you in going public about the personal? You know, there is that old saying that the personal is political. That's very hard for a lot of people.
My family supported me. In the beginning, I think that they had some trepidation about what I was going to say and how I was going to say it and how it would affect the family. I think that they have seen, as time has gone on, how important it has been.
I bet they were worried about it being embarrassing in some way. Not your illness, but just speaking that personally in public.
Well, I think people that don't talk about themselves in public would have that fear. And if they had that fear, they didn't want to stop me. They wanted me to do what I felt was important for me to do. They all said that they would support me in doing it. I do know that they had that fear, because we'd never done it. It wasn't something that we did. But I think in the long run, they've seen that it's been important and that it's helped other people. And that's the key, because I was raised like that. I was raised that it's important to help others. Mm-hmm. And they see that this has.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Mary Fisher's new book, Sleep with the Angels, is a collection of her speeches. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lawrence Walsh's final report on the Iran-Contra scandal shows the responsibility didn't just lie with a renegade group of subordinate officials. Coming up, we discuss the affair and the performance of the special prosecutor with Peter Kornbluh. He's a senior analyst with the National Security Archive, which used the Freedom of Information Act to declassify secret documents related to the scandal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Today is President Clinton's one-year anniversary in office, but a Washington ice storm scuttled his plans to celebrate the occasion with a speech. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Instead of a speech at his alma mater, Georgetown University, celebrating his first year's accomplishments, the president received the announcement that his attorney general, Janet Reno, had chosen Robert Fisk as the special counsel to run the investigation into the Clintons' land dealings in Arkansas. Fisk is a former federal prosecutor who served under Presidents Ford and Carter. Fisk said today that he would probably question both President Clinton and First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton under oath about their investment in the Whitewater Development Corporation. And Fisk said he would look into whether the suicide of Vince Foster, the White House aide who was handling the Clintons' personal financial business, had anything to do with Whitewater. Recently, Fisk served as the defense attorney for Washington lawyers Clark Clifford and Robert Altman in the BCCI scandal. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
With chill and rain in the forecast for Southern California, tens of thousands of people driven from their homes by Monday's earthquake are desperately seeking temporary shelter. Housing Secretary Henry Cisneros says that getting people out of makeshift quarters and into more permanent shelter is a top priority today. And he's told ABC another priority is water.
There's still some people in the Los Angeles area who are without any water in their homes, and the suggestion is that they may be without water for another week. So obviously that's an essential life component, and we've been focusing on getting water trucks and those plastic gallon jugs of water to people.
Cisneros says 11 disaster aid application centers have opened in Southern California. More rain is expected by this weekend. It will raise the risk of mudslides in areas shaken by the quake and stripped of ground cover by the fall firestorms. Federal health officials say people who have HIV, the virus that leads to AIDS, can live longer and better lives if primary care doctors follow new government guidelines on AIDS treatment. They emphasize care for women and kids, who are the fastest growing groups of people infected with HIV each year. It's estimated between 40 and 60,000 people are infected every year. The Commerce Department says new home construction shot up last year by 7.1%. That is the second yearly advance in a row after 5 years of decline. The number of new homes and apartments actually built last year was 1.29 million. That is the most completed in 4 years. Construction was up in every area of the United States except the Northeast, which slipped slightly. Stock prices set another record today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials added almost 8 points to close at 3,891. This is NPR. Mexican officials are claiming rebels of the Zapatista National Liberation Army are poised to seize 3 more towns in the southern Mexican state of Chiapas. That's despite efforts for a political solution to the conflict. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
Mexico's defense ministry has issued a statement charging that the armed Indian peasants who call themselves Zapatistas are planning to strike again despite a ceasefire declared a week ago by the government. Some 12,000 Mexican army troops are in the area, and there have been several clashes with the Zapatistas since the ceasefire took effect. Officials here claim the Mexican army is holding its fire unless attacked, but the Zapatistas say that's not true. Meanwhile, there's growing skepticism here about a general amnesty that Mexico's president proposed on Sunday. Critics say the measure, which is currently being debated in Congress, is unlikely to stop the fighting in Chiapas. The amnesty covers only the period from January 1st, when the uprising began, through last Sunday. The rebels could be prosecuted for all violations of the law since then. I'm David Wallen in Mexico City.
Shannon Faulkner has become the first woman to attend day classes at the all-male Citadel Military College in South Carolina. Cadets shouted and women supporters yelled encouragement as she entered the school today. Faulkner was allowed to attend class by Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist while her lawsuit against the school's all-male policy is settled. The British government has released a report blaming the captain of a tanker that ran aground in the Shetland Islands last year for a serious dereliction of duty. Millions of gallons of oil were spilled into the ocean. The report says the captain didn't fasten down spare steel pipes that broke loose on the ship. The pipes damaged the ship's air pipes, letting water seep aboard and contaminating the fuel tanks. Eventually, the main engine failed, the crew abandoned ship, and hours later, the ship ran aground. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Lawrence Walsh's 7-year investigation into the Iran-Contra affair ended this week with the publication of his final report. My guest Peter Kornbluh says the special prosecutor's report not only offers a thorough look at the Iran-Contra story, it's also the last major narrative on the inner workings of the national security apparatus in the Cold War era. Kornbluh is the co-editor of the Iran-Contra scandal, the declassified history, which tells the story of the scandal through 100 of the most revealing secret documents. Kornbluh is a senior analyst with the National Security Archive, which uses the Freedom of Information Act to obtain secret government documents for scholars, journalists, and Congress. The Walsh Report concludes that both Ronald Reagan and George Bush knew about the arms for hostages deal, but Walsh is more critical of Bush than Reagan.
Walsh has bent over backwards to be magnanimous to Ronald Reagan. It's extraordinary. His report makes it clear that Reagan participated or acquiesced in the cover-up of his own actions with regards to the 1985 arms sales to Iran, which he had been told at the time by his own Secretary of Defense were illegal. Walsh's soft treatment of Reagan, his respectful treatment of the former president, is totally in contrast to the scathing attacks that Ronald Reagan and his lawyer and other members of Reagan's cabinet have launched on Lawrence Walsh, but we can talk about those in a second. In terms of George Bush, the Walsh Report makes it clear that Bush grossly misled the American public in 1986 and 1987 about his own knowledge of the Iran operations and the Contra operations. He ran for president in 1988 on the basis of denying that he knew anything about these operations, really. He said, "I was out of the loop on the Iran-Contra operations." And the Walsh Report proves once and for all that George Bush was in the room and in the loop as the Iran operations were being discussed and implemented, that he favored the arms for hostages transfers, and that he was a participant in the illicit effort to resupply the Contras in Nicaragua after Congress cut off all aid to the Contras and banned the United States from supporting them. I think where Walsh is particularly and overtly angry at George Bush, and rightfully so, is for the pardons. George Bush stepped in and obstructed Lawrence Walsh's investigation of Iran-Contra. He aborted the two trials that were pending in early 1993, that of Caspar Weinberger, the former Secretary of Defense, and a high CIA official, Duane Claridge. He also went ahead and pardoned four other Reagan administration officials who had pled guilty to both federal and misdemeanor crimes. And in so doing, he terminated abruptly Walsh's investigation and prevented the American public from hearing the full body of evidence about the cover-up in the White House that certainly would have come out at the Weinberger trial. And Walsh's point is that there was nothing in the public interest of doing this, that Bush was doing this for self-serving reasons. It meant that he would not have to testify after his presidency ended, and that his own role in the scandal would not be revealed. In fact, now it has been revealed in the Walsh Report.
Walsh says that the investigation of Bush was regrettably incomplete. What information did he hope to get that he hasn't gotten?
You know, George Bush concealed relevant documents from the congressional and Lawrence Walsh's investigators. He was asked in 1987 to turn over all relevant personal and professional documents relating to Iran-Contra. George Bush knew full well that he had dictated notes on the day-by-day meetings that were taking place in the White House as the Iran-Contra scandal unraveled. And yet he withheld those notes from Lawrence Walsh and Congress until 1992, after the election had already taken place and the statute of limitations on concealing evidence had run out. Now, let me just say that one of the most interesting things in the Walsh report is his discussion of the Bush diaries. Bush released his diaries a year ago, this week, as a matter of fact. But he had already gone through them and taken out parts that he didn't want anybody to see. He claimed at the time, through his lawyer, Griffin Bell, that those sections of the diaries were not relevant. They were had nothing to do with Iran-Contra. But now we know from the Walsh report that, in fact, there was a diary entry where Bush wrote, or better said, dictated into his dictaphone, that he had just discovered that George Shultz, the Secretary of State, and he's writing this now in November, December of 1986, that George Shultz, the diary says, had taken 700 pages of contemporaneous notes on the meetings involving Iran-Contra and was going to turn those over to congressional investigators, as he had been asked to do under the law. And George Bush dictates, "I'm appalled that he kept such notes. I certainly would not turn my notes over to investigators." And that's, I think, a very important and revealing passage about the cover-up that I think Walsh has revealed Bush participated in.
Walsh has concluded that President Reagan's impeachment should have been considered. On what grounds?
On the grounds that Ronald Reagan deliberately participated in and acquiesced to a cover-up of his own role in the 1985 arms shipments to Iran, which he and his men both knew and believed to have been illegal. Walsh uncovered evidence in the form of contemporaneous notes taken at the meetings that Reagan attended in November of 1986 after the story of these arms sales broke, and as the president and his men were trying to come up with how this would be responded to, how it would be presented to the American public, those notes showed that a cover-up was formed. Meese presented the facts to the American public on November 25, 1986, saying the president did not know about these arms shipments. In fact, these are shipments that were conducted by Israel, not by the United States. That was factually false, and the evidence that Walsh uncovered showed that the president did know and was a participant in the meetings to cover up this initiative. It is on that grounds, a Watergate-style cover-up, even a cover-up that I would argue goes beyond Watergate in its importance, that Walsh suggested that had Congress had the evidence in 1987, they might have considered impeachment against Ronald Reagan.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Kornbluh. He's a senior analyst with the National Security Archive and co-editor of the book The Iran-Contra Scandal, The Declassified History, which tells the story of the scandal through documents that the archive has gotten declassified over the years. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive, a group that specializes in declassifying government documents. And he's the co-editor of the Iran-Contra Scandal, The Declassified History. Walsh has gotten his share of criticisms for how he conducted this investigation. He's been criticized for spending too much money, about $40 million, for taking too long, 7 years, and for finally not having really put in anyone behind bars except one person who wasn't even a key figure. Senator Dole said, "Walsh's witch hunt is a case study in prosecutorial abuse and excess." Do you share those criticisms of Walsh? Do you think that he took too long or spent too much money or didn't get enough done?
I don't share those criticisms. And Terry, I can tell you there were really three basic reasons for the costs and the length of Walsh's investigation. The first one is that he faced a wall of cover-up. It was hard to break through that wall. It took time. Major pieces of evidence were concealed until 1992, almost 6 years after the scandal broke. The second major reason his investigation took so long is because Congress had given immunity to the key figures in the scandal, John Poindexter, Oliver North, and others. And Walsh successfully tried these two men. He won 3 out of 12 charges against Oliver North, 5 out of 5 charges against John Poindexter. But unfortunately, those convictions were reversed on appeal because they had essentially both admitted to this wrongdoing under immunity in their testimony before Congress. That was Congress's mistake, I would argue, not Walsh's, in terms of the law. And the third reason is President Bush's obstruction of Walsh's investigation and his decision to abort 3 of the trials that Walsh had spent more than 3 years preparing for. Those trials were the 1989 trial of CIA station chief in Costa Rica, Joseph Fernandez. Walsh had spent a year preparing to bring this to trial on the eve of sitting a jury. The Bush administration decided not to release documents that the judge had determined were necessary for the defense in this case, and the judge threw out the charges. 2 other trials, that of Caspar Weinberger and Duane Claridge, Bush aborted by giving preemptive pardons on Christmas Eve, 1992.
The special prosecutor law has expired, though it may be revived by Congress. What powers did the special prosecutor law give, and how is its absence affecting us now?
Well, its absence has prevented the Republicans from being able to force through a new independent counsel quickly to investigate President Clinton and the Whitewater scandal. But more importantly, the debate over reenacting the independent counsel statute has focused largely on making it a weaker statute. And I think that what Lawrence Walsh's experience shows is that the Independent Counsel Act has to be strengthened. It has to be strengthened to give an independent counsel additional powers when it comes to criminality conducted under the guise of national security. Because national security involves classified information, and Walsh turned out to be not independent, but dependent on the very agencies that he was investigating in order to obtain the declassification of evidence that needed to be used for criminal prosecutions. Because that was a factor, and because the Reagan administration and the Bush administration did not cooperate in that declassification, and in fact obstructed that declassification of evidence, Walsh was not able to charge anybody with the core of the scandal, that is, the diversion of funds between the Iran operations and the Contra operations. He indicted North and Poindexter on charges relating to the diversion, but he had to drop those charges because the Reagan administration would not release the documentation. Similarly, in the case of Joe Fernandez, the CIA station chief, that trial was aborted because the Bush administration would not declassify the documents. So in the future, if we are going to have expedient independent counsel investigations and prosecutions relating to national security crimes, we are going to have a stronger independent counsel law.
Tell us about the document you chose for the cover of your book on the declassified history of the Iran-Contra scandal and why that document is so revealing.
That document is verbatim notes of a June 25, 1984 meeting of the National Security Planning Group, the highest-level national security decision-making body in the Reagan administration. Here is a meeting, according to these notes, with the president, the vice president, secretary of state, the secretary of defense. These are verbatim minutes, a virtual transcript. It allows the reader to be a fly on the wall of the inner sanctum of a major national security meeting at which it was discussed how the Reagan administration was going to circumvent the congressional ban on aid to the Contras by going to third countries and asking them to become the financiers of this illicit covert war in Central America. And you have the president saying we should do this, and you have Secretary of State Shultz saying to the President of the United States, Mr. President, that could be an impeachable offense. And then you have the President of the United States concluding the meeting by saying to everybody, this is a sensitive issue. Don't anybody leak this issue. If anybody leaks it, we will be hanging from our thumbs in front of the White House waiting to find out who did it. That's the type of candid look into the inner sanctum of the national security establishment, if you will, that you can get out of these documents.
I think the popular view of Iran-Contra early on was that the scandal was the responsibility of a shadow government created by subordinate officers. Does the Walsh Report change that?
It certainly does. The Walsh Report sets the record straight for the verdict of history, I would argue. It states that, in fact, that was the popular myth about Iran-Contra, that a, quote, cabal of zealots, unquote, as Congress put it in its 1987 report, operating out of the basement of the White House, ran these operations unbeknownst to the President of the United States, who was somewhat befuddled about what was really going on. The Walsh Report changes that history once and for all. It shows that the Iran and Contra operations were directed and authorized by the President of the United States, implemented with his knowledge, as well as that the cover-up of these operations was also directed and acquiesced to by the President of the United States. This was not a rogue elephant operation. This was an operation run at the highest levels of the Reagan White House. That is very, very important history. What we do with that history to prevent this from happening again is up to us.
Peter Kornbluh is co-editor of the Iran-Contra Scandal, The Declassified History, published by the New Press. This is Fresh Air. Between the earthquake and frigid weather, a lot of the country has virtually shut down. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what we have on that on All Things Considered?
We'll have a general roundup of what is happening with the weather around the country, Terry, and take a look at the power grid and how that is working, and deal with one of the interesting problems we're having here in Washington, where only essential people are supposed to come in, which is causing an individual crisis for many people. One of the federal emergency management offices are online in California, and the California commuting arrangements are still being worked out. And, of course, we'll be covering the naming of a special counsel in the Whitewater investigation.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Even though it's a new year, rock critic Ken Tucker is still catching up with pop music from 1993 to make sure that no worthy releases have been overlooked. He's found two such efforts, Sheryl Crow's debut album, Tuesday Night Music Club, and this one, Jane Sibbery's When I Was a Boy.
Come on, baby, come on, give me. 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 Come on, baby. Come on, give me.
I owe Jane Sibbery an apology. When this Canadian singer-songwriter's sixth release arrived at my house late last year, I didn't exactly race to the CD player to listen to it. Having heard all of Sibbery's previous collections, I'd pretty much written her off as the sort of cult pop eccentric I have no use for. With her loopy romantic discursiveness and lyrics that can best be described as blissfully addled, I'd always found Sibbery's music to be pretty but empty. But when I finally got around to playing When I Was a Boy, I found myself, over the course of weeks and months, putting it on again and again, almost without realizing what I was doing. In a way, this suits the music here, which has a dreamy urgency that's new to Sibbery's work. Her words are still mostly moony cliches, but in a song like Love Is Everything, the sheer harmonic gorgeousness of the music overwhelms any flaws.
Till you make the whole kingdom come. So live.
Where Jane Sibbery wants to create a kind of waking dream state in her listeners, Sheryl Crow is more direct and earthy, grappling with the here and now. For a debut album, Tuesday Night Music Club is a remarkably assured piece of work, which creates an atmosphere of instant intimacy.
Life springs eternal on a garden neon street. Not that I care at all. It's been the best part of my losing streak in an army jeep for what I can't recall.
In a way, Sheryl Crow's album is a state-of-the-art version of the kind of singer-songwriter music that Joni Mitchell perfected in the early 70s. Tuesday Night Music Club is Court and Spark for the 90s, with all the irony and loss of innocence that that implies. What I really like about Crow is that, even when she's in pain, as she admits to being on this terrific song called Can't Cry Anymore, she turns it into a tough-minded piece of rock and roll.
Took your car, drove to Texas. Sorry, honey, but I suspected we were through, and I can't cry anymore. Well, since I left, feeling better, 'cause that's what you get when you stay together too long.
Having been chastened by my Jane Sibbery experience, I resolve in 1994 to play whatever she releases as soon as I receive it. But what I'm really hoping is that Sheryl Crow has a second album in her as good as her first, and that she puts it out soon.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed albums by Jane Sibbery and Sheryl Crow. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, acting and actors. Peter O'Toole remembers riding camels in the desert while making Lawrence of Arabia. And James Earl Jones, famous for his authoritative voice, tells us about his stutter. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.